It's not too late to diversify into gold. Physical gold was used to preserve wealth throughout history, and now is a great time to include it in your savings strategy. Birch Gold Group makes the process straightforward. They help you convert an existing IRA or a 401k into a tax-advantaged physical gold IRA without any out-of-pocket costs. Just text HOPE to 989898 and claim your free info kit on gold IRAs. Protect your savings today. Hello and welcome back to A Reason for Hope. My name is Mario Costabile and I am honored that you're joining us and listening to us today. Thanks for tuning in to A Reason for Hope podcast, your resource for interviews, catechesis, and candid conversations about our Catholic faith. Also, if you'd like to send us any of your thoughts or ideas, you can email us at podcast@arrayofhope.net. Make sure that you subscribe and follow us on your favorite podcast app so we can walk together on this journey of faith. And lastly, please prayerfully consider going to our donation page so you can help us do our work and serve the church. Our partnership with you will allow us to continue to create these podcasts. You can go to arrayofhope.org and navigate to the donation page. So today, David and I will continue our discussion about the Creed. So let's get into it. And here we go. Hey, Dave.
How are you doing? I'm good.
Good.
Yeah.
Everything good at the home front?
Yeah, we're doing great.
Awesome.
Yeah, everything's really good. How about you guys?
It's good. It's really good. I'm thrilled to death that the spring is around the corner. So, and it's getting warm and I like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
In fact, isn't it technically spring?
Yeah, it is. Doesn't feel it, but soon it'll be, maybe by the time people hear this, it'll be
probably.
Spring. We'll be into it. The flowers will be budding.
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Real resurrection.
Yeah. Amen.
Which is, you know, good.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about that.
I love the series, the creed that we're doing, and I love how it's evolving. I love the fact that it sparked a lot of interest online. People are really resonating with it and learning about various aspects of what this, you know, the creed means. And the next few episodes are very interesting, in particular, the one that we're going to be covering today, you know, the mystery of mysteries. Last time we discussed the scandal, or you could say the suffering, you know, of God. Right? Pretty much. And today we're going to go deep into what Jesus actually suffered. And I think there's a mystery to the passion and there's a mystery of what happened after the passion that I'm curious to hear you explain it and discuss it. In particular, you know, what happened after his death and then he ascended into hell. And a lot of people don't understand that premise, you know, and the fact that he rose from the dead on the third day and then ascended into heaven. You know, after 40 days, you know, and then, you know, now sits at the right hand of the Father. So chronologically, a lot of stuff happened in that period, and there are aspects that are difficult to grasp. So I'm interested to see, you know, how you explain that.
Yeah. And what's incredible about the Creed is it just kind of lists them real fast.
Right.
Right. So if you went to the Apostles' Creed, it just kind of tells you very factually that these are the things that happen. We're going to dig into them, I think, a little bit. And all of them together, by the way, are usually called the Paschal mystery. So you've got the suffering death of Jesus. You've got the descent into hell, which happens when his body is in the tomb immediately after his death. And then you have his resurrection, 40 days later, ascension, sitting at the right hand of the Father. That whole thing is called the Paschal Mysteries. You could really say it's the mystery of all mysteries. Now, what's, I think, important to start with is that all of the deeds and actions of Christ throughout his entire life were salvific, okay? So everything Jesus did, everything that Jesus experienced, every suffering he ever endured was saving. But when we're talking about like the essential events that have to do with our salvation, we're talking about the Paschal mystery. We're talking about the events of Holy Week and then the ascension 40 days after Easter Sunday. So we can get into each of those things, and I think it's probably important for us to do so. Mm-hmm. So why don't we dive in with passion? The word passion, we tend to think about passion in terms of, I love you. You know, like it's just like, you know, we tend to think of it in a certain way. And yet the word passion comes from the Latin word passio, which means suffering.
Mm.
So the passion of Christ is about the suffering of Christ.
Mm.
And we did talk last time about how it's an odd thing to say that God suffered. If you're late to the game, you can go back and play that episode because I think that would be a good thing for you to do.
Yeah.
How can we even say that God suffered? But we're going to look at this and you know, it's interesting. Not a lot of effort is put into really reflecting on these things. And yet whenever I teach about the suffering of Jesus and what he endured, I always find that my students are locked in and it's very, very fruitful for them. There's almost a whole attitude, it seems sometimes, that we shouldn't talk about the suffering because Jesus rose from the dead, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the rationale, I may have said this even before on in the series, that sometimes the rationale is, oh, well, it's treated very, very quickly in the gospel and even in the creed. You know, the passion or suffering of Jesus is treated very quickly. So why are we spending a lot of time on it? And well, the fact is that in those days, you didn't need to explain it because Roman crucifixion was a part of their lives.
Day-to-day thing.
Right,
exactly. Things happened all the time.
So yet, therefore, we who are so remote from those Roman times have to kind of dig into it. So.
Well, I mean, Jesus' suffering is always something that I like to reflect on, especially when I think about what he endured. And, you know, I have a great devotion to the shroud. And the shroud is a negative image of a suffering man that was crucified. And we all believe, and I believe, that it was Jesus himself. So you see the scourgings on his back and on his chest. And I always think about the scourging of the pillar in the movie, The Passion of the Christ, which really had a profound impression on me when I saw that. So it always brings me to a place on the immense love that Jesus has for each and every one of us when I meditate on that. So I think the suffering of Jesus is an important aspect of what we're going to share.
Yeah, and truthfully, the saints have said next to the sacraments, there's probably no act of greater spiritual benefit than to meditate on the cross of Jesus.
Mm.
And one reason for that is that the passion and suffering of Jesus on the cross makes clear God's great love for us. He didn't need to suffer on the cross that way in order to save us. And yet St. Thomas Aquinas says he did so because it was fitting not only to procure our salvation, but to accomplish other ends. One of those ends being to demonstrate the profound love that God has for each and every one of us. But there's also another thing that his death and suffering tells us. And that is the seriousness of sin, and that sin's no light thing. So we need to have both of those things, I think, in tension. We need to look at a cross and on the one hand say, wow, that's what my sin did, right? And then on the other hand say, but that's what God's love did, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there's that 1-2 punch of the cross. And so for what it's worth, you know, I think that we can go into it. You mentioned the scourging at the pillar. We could just kind of step back a little before that and talk about the agony in the garden and Jesus, you know, sweating blood because of the immense sorrow and stress that he was under. We know that anybody who suffers any kind of emotional stress in their life, it's physically exhausting. You know, so here's Jesus seeing before his eyes, if you would, the sins that have ever been committed, are being committed, and will ever be committed that he is taking upon himself, and the weight of all of that on him at that moment, let alone, of course, his human reaction to the suffering that he was going to be enduring. There is a whole element of that that caused such a psychological and emotional pain and suffering that St. Luke indicates that Jesus actually sweat blood. So there's already loss of blood. There's an incredible amount of emotional and psychological suffering. And we're not even out of the garden yet. And then Jesus is arrested. And this is depicted in Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, as well. Probably not treated very kindly along the way, right? Roughed up, beat up. And then after he is brought before the high priest, after he's convicted falsely of, actually, you could almost say that, you know, they got it right. He did say he was the Son of God. What they got wrong was that he wasn't really the Son of God. So they thought he was blaspheming. So he's convicted, you know, for being a blasphemer when he wasn't. He was simply telling the truth. It says in the scriptures that they would strike him. And what's really interesting is that I was just reading this the other day. Matthew's gospel has them striking them with their open hand. You know, this is something that maybe our listeners haven't like thought about, but when Jesus in his own teaching says, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, offer them the left as well, it's often seen as like this act of passivity in the face of violence, but it's not, because most people would strike you with their right hand. So guess what? If you're getting struck on the right cheek by somebody with their right hand, you're getting backhanded. It's a lot different when you strike somebody with an open hand. There's not only more force, right? But it's more of a brazen act to strike somebody with an open hand than with a backhand. So when Jesus says, when they strike you on the right cheek, offer them the left, that means you're almost like saying, okay, now bring it with your open palm. There's an act of strength there, a willingness to take it, but are you willing to give it with an open palm, right? The fact that when Jesus, after he gets convicted, it makes clear that he's being hit with an open palm is a big deal from the kind of disrespect they're showing him, how hard they're striking him, and all of these other things, you see? And yet he gets to fulfill his own command. He turns the other cheek and accepts the open palm. So there's all these kind of details that when you look at the passion narratives, you can pick up. But, you know, he doesn't know where it's coming from. So that must mean that they blindfolded him or something, because they tell him, play the prophet, tell us who hit you. So that's also a little detail that people might not pick up. And now imagine not knowing where the next hit is coming from or when. That's all what's going on. So Jesus isn't even to Pilate and at the scourging, and he's already been sufficiently roughed up.
Yeah.
And he's already lost blood. He's already probably swollen in his face, all those kinds of things. Now also remember, he's gone from the Last Supper. He's going to go from that all the way till his death without eating.
So Dave, so he gets the Pontius Pilate, right? And Pontius Pilate has him scourged. And what happens from there?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ indicates two different things going on with Jesus there, because the scriptures do. Some of the gospels talk about flogging. Other ones talk about scourging. Those are actually technically different things. Flogging is being like whipped with like a reed,
right,
which would have caused surface bleeding and a welt and bruises. Scourging was an entirely different thing that used a weapon that had like maybe like three leather straps that had iron balls or hooks or
crazy
things like this on it.
Crazy.
It would actually rip into the flesh and pull it off. So the idea is that probably both happened, and that's what Gibson portrays in The Passion of the Christ. But you have to imagine, and that means front and back. So when Jesus is chained at the pillar, they're whipping him on the back, but then they would probably have let one of his arms free, which flipped him over, and then they would whip him on the front and scourge him on the front. So by the end of this, Jesus is really he's a bloodbath, really.
Yeah.
He's probably got, you know, muscle and bone exposed from the scourging. He's been very roughed up all night. He's hasn't had food or drink. Like, there's very little left, you know? And then shows you, by the way, how strong he must have been, like physically strong, because he endures that, and he still does initially carry the cross.
Yeah.
Right? So it's pretty profound. So then he's crowned with thorns. Of course, the crowning with thorns, according to the shroud, wasn't just like around the forehead and the back of the head, but was all over the top of the head, so that when he's getting beat on top of the head, the whole cap is like being pushed into his head. So he's bleeding there too. And that's just an added suffering as well as loss of blood. So think about the amount of blood he's lost before he even picks up this cross and brings it to the place where he's going to be crucified, you know? And then when he gets there, he's crucified on this cross. Now, Roman crucifixion was a carefully thought out, torturous process. And one of the things that people might be confused by is sometimes you'll see the nail wounds in Jesus' hands, but then it got really kind of faddish to say, oh, he didn't get nailed in the hands, he got nailed in the wrist. And then people would say, but the scriptures say the hands. And then people try to argue, yes, but the scriptures in Hebrew, there wasn't a word for just the hands, so it's the whole area. And there's all these word games. Well, how about we look at what Roman crucifixion did most of the time? And that was that they probably went in the hand, but there's a nerve. This is why, like, you never have a friend who like does mercy with you and grabs your hand and gets the pressure point.
Very sensitive nerve there.
So they're trying to pierce that nerve, because that nerve, when it's pierced, it's going to send a shock all the way through your arms, right? But they don't want to go right through because there's no way to hold you up. So they go in on an angle and out the back of the wrist
to support the body weight.
Because there's a nice little space in the wrist that could hold you well. So it was probably on an angle this way and out. So that's why on the shroud, the blood coagulates around the shroud, the back of the wrist.
Yeah.
But if you were to have flipped their hands over, it probably would have been right in the inset of the hand, mm-hmm. by the thumb. So that's what they're doing. And then they nail both feet together. The way somebody typically died, which obviously there was shock involved with like blood loss and all these sorts of things that the body's going to be going through, but it's predominantly asphyxiation. So somebody is, their lungs are filling up with fluid. The only way to like really get themselves breathing well is to push up on the feet and pull up on the hands, but that sends that shock pain. Wave of pain through the entire body. And so this is what Roman crucifixion is. It's like, you know, gasping for breath, releasing, having this intense pain, can't handle it, try to get my breath, you know, like all these kinds of things going back and forth, back and forth. If somebody weren't as beat up as Jesus, they would have taken a lot longer, because there's actually not a lot of blood loss from the nails in the hands or the feet. They avoid the front part of the wrist because they don't want to pierce the arteries that are going to bleed them out. Right. So like the idea is that they're going to bleed and suffer for as long as possible. But Jesus was practically dead when he got there. Mm-hmm. And then he took 3 hours to die, right? So you got to imagine the intense suffering, and from head to toe, just covered in blood. And yet that was for us to show us the depths of God's love, but also the severity of sin.
Incredible. So Jesus dies on the cross eventually after the 3 hours, and he's laid in the tomb. So what do we believe happened next?
Yeah, we believe that at the moment of Jesus' death, that his soul descended into hell. Now, this is often confusing for people because they think, why would Jesus go to hell? Right? That's like where all the bad people go, right? But it takes us understanding what Jesus understood and what the early church understood to be what the afterlife was like prior to Jesus opening the gates of heaven. Hell actually had multiple regions. So there was a region that was the hell of the damned, or the hell of fire. That's where the people who were bad, evil, had done evil deeds, would go for punishment. But then there was this great gulf that existed between the hell of the damned and the other region of hell, which has become known as the limbo of the fathers. That's where, for example, even the great patriarchs went, were Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and David. That's where they all were, in addition to all the people who had lived with an upright heart in anticipation of God's salvation. So you have a sort of group that was the good people who died, who it was still a place of punishment, even though it was a place of natural happiness, it was still a place of punishment because they were deprived of heaven and the beatific vision, right? So they didn't have the joys of heaven, but they also weren't suffering punishment in the sense of the people who were in the hell of fire, the hell of the damned. To get a good sense of this, by the way, you could look at, for example, the story of the rich man and Lazarus that Jesus himself tells, because it shows that he understands and accepts this view of the afterlife. When Lazarus the beggar dies, right, who just longs for the scraps that fall from the rich man's table but gets none, right? And then the rich man dies, you've got Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham, and you've got the rich man burning in the flames. And when the rich man yells out,
mm-hmm.
Abraham says to him, there's an uncrossable gulf between you and us.
Mm.
So Abraham, in that story that Jesus is telling, talks about this uncrossable gulf that exists between the hell of fire, which is the place of punishment, and this place where Abraham is. But that place is not heaven. It doesn't say that Lazarus goes to be with God. He goes to be with Abraham. So this was the prevalent Jewish idea of the afterlife in among a certain group of Jews at the time of Jesus, which Jesus, I believe, by telling this story,
affirms.
And then, so then the question is, where does Jesus go? He goes to the limbo of the fathers. He doesn't go to the hell of the damned. He goes to hell in the sense of to where Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David.
Magnificat has changed the daily prayer life of millions of Catholics worldwide. Each monthly pocket-sized issue includes prayers for the morning and evening, daily mass prayers and readings, meditations, saints' lives, essays, and more. Magnificat helps you pray the way the Church prays. Email offers@magnificat.com to request a free copy. Visit Magnificat online by clicking on their website link in the show notes for this episode, or download the app free for a month. Explore Magnificat and give your prayer life the beauty it deserves.
So if you're wondering how you can help this ministry, rating and reviewing this podcast is the best way to help others hear it, as well as sharing it with your friends and your family. So join us in this mission by rating, reviewing, or sharing this episode with someone you think needs to hear it. And we want to thank you for your continued support of A Reason for Hope podcast.
So I'll just interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
So in this limbo part of hell, so are we to believe that that no longer exists because Jesus instituted heaven in a way?
Or? That's right. In fact, we call it the harrowing of hell,
mm-hmm.
because Jesus empties the limbo of the fathers,
right.
and he brings them all with him to heaven when he ascends to heaven. So so this is, I think, a key point that Jesus goes to the limbo of the fathers, but why does he go there? Why does he descend there? To announce to them the joyful tidings of their redemption and to preach to the souls of the just.
Mm.
So Jesus goes there to announce the good news of their redemption. And then when he eventually ascends into heaven, he takes them all with him. Obviously, it makes no sense that they would go to heaven before he does. So he leads the way with them at his ascension. So now all you have is heaven and hell, the hell of the damned, which is the Christian cosmology. Even purgatory, we would say, is not limbo, and it's not hell, but it's a place of purgation whereby those people would automatically go to heaven. In fact, the limbo of the fathers was always thought to be a temporary place too, that would disappear when the Messiah came, you know, and gave redemption to Israel. So this is, I think, an important thing.
Well, let me ask another question. So isn't purgatory referenced in the Old Testament?
Yes, but
they didn't have
a concept of purgatory. There's Old Testament references to purgatory that when they're looked at in light of the truth that Christ brings and the truth that Christ is, now we understand those passages to be referring to purgatory. Just like much of the Old Testament, you've got a Christian reads the Old Testament through Christian lenses, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
So there's things that are seen there that now are understood to have been types of truths to come. So purgatory is one of them. But St. Thomas Aquinas says that the fires of purgatory, because it's often depicted as fire, St. Paul, when he talks about purgatory, talks about it in terms of fire, that the fires of purgatory are the fires of hell of the damned. But they just kind of like, the very tops and heat of them kind of hit those souls who are being purified in order to go to heaven.
Yeah. So, and I can't remember, there are saints that talk about that.
Yep.
You know, that, you know, share, I guess, their vision or their understanding of purgatory.
Right. And it's always depicted as a place of suffering and a place of torment and a place that's associated with fire, you know. But the fact of the matter is, though, it's temporary and everybody who's in purgatory will eventually go to heaven.
I'll throw you a curve.
All right.
So what about the transfiguration where Elijah and Moses, like, where were they coming from?
Yeah, so this is interesting. Elijah was said to have been brought up into heaven in a fiery chariot. There's nothing that ever indicates in the scriptures that Elijah died. And in fact, there's two Old Testament figures who are said not to have died. That's Elijah and Enoch. And they pop up again in apocalyptic literature as the ones who are going to announce the final coming and the end of the world. So that's interesting in and of itself, but it's maybe far beyond what we can deal with
here. What
about
Moses? Then where'd he come from?
Yeah, then Moses would have appeared, but he would have come from the limbo of the fathers. You know, so Elijah wasn't in heaven when he went to heaven in a fiery chariot. It wasn't like heaven meaning the beatific vision.
Yeah. Hey, listeners, are you following all this?
So.
I hope I'm being clear. I think it's really interesting, and these thoughts just are thoughts of curiosity.
Yeah,
you know, and how the whole puzzle is put together.
So Elijah, wherever he was, having ever died, according to the biblical tradition, and then Moses would have been, he did die, and his soul would have taken some sort of visible form for the apostles on the Mount of Transfiguration, but he would have been in limbo of the fathers. So that's where he would have come from.
So let's take a minute about the resurrection of Jesus then.
Just a minute, though.
Well,
getting
this
ready
podcast.
I know, this is a long one. We got a lot to
cover.
Well,
it's okay. There's a lot of stuff, but it's interesting in the sense that there's a lot. I mean, we go by the creed, like you said, so fast, but
yeah, these things are mentioned really quickly.
There's so many deeper components of what we're saying that I think it's important to articulate it. So let's talk about the resurrection then.
Yeah, okay. So what do we believe about Jesus rising from the dead? Well, we believe that he was dead. His soul separated from his body, his soul descended into hell, and then his soul re-entered that same body and animated it, but yet it in all of his glory. So there was a reunion of the body and soul of the human body and soul of Jesus, okay?
Why do you think the people didn't recognize him?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's hard to know. Did he conceal his identity from them? In other words, did he cause them to not be able to see them? Did their own circumstances cause them not to be able to recognize them? Clearly, it seems like in certain instances, he was still able to veil his glory. Because if he were just radiating all the time, like everybody would have known that it was him, right? Yet he's with the disciples on the road to Emmaus, and they have no idea that it's him. Yep.
I have a theory.
Yeah, I'd love to.
You could shoot me down, but
I know.
So, and we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about our own resurrected bodies, right?
That's the last
but
episode.
I believe that our own resurrected bodies, when that happens at the end of time, it's going to happen, right? That we're going to be slightly different.
Yes.
We're not going to have, like, it's not going to be Mario, you know, in his 60s. you know?
No.
It's going to be a different
But we'll all be Jesus'
Mario
age.
Mario, very athletic, playing football. And
No, you will, definitely. And Dave. And Dave
playing baseball.
Yeah, and maybe about 3 inches or so taller.
That's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
So, like,
but you know what I mean?
Yeah, no.
But this is the, I think this is an interesting point. But in our cases, it would be our physical bodies perfected and glorified. So whatever our perfect body is, it's not like the perfect body, but whatever our perfect body is, we would be free from all of the defects.
Right.
So in that sense, we're going to appear different, right?
Yeah.
I don't know that if you would say that about Christ, because I don't think that his physical body had any defects. So, and our glorified bodies rather would be conformed to his, configured to his, which is why like somebody like Archbishop Fulton Sheen said that everybody's 33 at the resurrection of the body.
Interesting.
You know, like, so like that, because that's Jesus's perfect age. That's the age he died and rose.
Yeah, I was pretty good at 33. You know?
So yeah, 33 wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so bad.
Good. Awesome.
A lot different than 53. All right, so, and 63.
Hey,
you're 63?
Don't tell everybody my age. Come on, folks, I'm really not 63. Good.
All right, so yeah, but like, so keep this in mind though, that it's the self-same body. That's really, really important. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about this when we talk about the resurrection of the body on the last episode.
Right.
But like, it is the very body, flesh and bone of Jesus. And he even says this to his apostles. Like when his apostles see him resurrected and they're like, wow, like, you know, this is a ghost. He says, a ghost does not have flesh and bone like me. So check that out. That's a big deal. He's risen from the dead, and he says he has flesh and bone. And then he says, do you have something to eat? So he eats, which means he has a mouth and teeth and a stomach. You know, like that he's got an earthly body. But his human body and human soul are completely one, such that the physical body takes on the spiritual components of his human soul and his divinity, such that it's a real body with flesh and bone, but it's spiritualized, glorified, radiating his divinity. So in that sense, his body does not operate like an ordinary body. Like, for example, like locked doors don't seem to matter. You know, like he can be in more than one place at a time. So there's all these different things, and the gospel writers go to great lengths to talk about how Jesus's body is the same and yet not, right? How it is like a normal physical body with flesh and bone, but is not. It's been spiritualized, glorified, and these are the terms in which St. Paul describes the resurrected body.
You know, I mean, this is really our entire Christian faith rests on the resurrection. Without the resurrection, there's no Catholicism, there's no Christianity. But it's amazing that there is solid proof that this happened, right?
Yeah.
It's like it's real.
Yeah, and I think this is a great point. St. Paul says that if Christ did not rise, then there is no resurrection of the dead. You are dead in your sins. All those who have died are condemned, and I'm the greatest of fools and most pitiable of all men. Like St. Paul was laying it out. It's all on the resurrection of Jesus. But he says, but of course, Jesus rose from the dead. Why? Because he saw him not only once, but multiple times, right? Certainly on the road to Damascus. So the resurrection is everything. And yet this is important because it's not like there's myths of resurrected gods or whatever, you know, that are in some ancient literature. And people like to, you might say, take Christianity and make it just another kind of like old myth. And yet that's anything but the way the apostles and the Christians saw Christianity. They were talking about real events. I mean, if you think about like the Gospel of Luke, he's situating, you know, when this person was ruling here, this person was ruling here, this person was ruling there, this was happening, that was happening, there was a census. You know, like it's the historical reality, that's when Jesus is born. There's so much to situate things historically. They call it the scandal of particularity, that Jesus, the Son of God, became man in a particular place at a particular time and it really happened, right? Well, in a way, that's why Pontius Pilate shows up in the creed, because it's like, okay, Jesus really died and it was under this guy at this time, right?
Yeah.
So there's a real intentionality there saying, no, we're talking about historical events. The resurrection too, historical event, to great lengths to go to say that it's a historical event. Well, let's just even think about the facts surrounding the resurrection. We have a few things here. These are facts that everybody has to accept. I mean, there's no disputing these facts. Number one, Jesus died by Roman crucifixion. That's a fact. Attested to multiple historical sources, not only the Gospels. Okay, so...
I want to put a little preface. Most historians point to the Gospels as true, authentic historical documents.
As they are, and yeah. They're written independently of
one
another.
Well, sometimes people say it's the Bible.
I know, and they shrug it off, right? Again, like, but it's like a myth. But these things came up at different times. They were developed in different areas. Mm-hmm. So they were written to different audiences. It wasn't like, and if people just even understand the world back then, they didn't have, hey, let me send you this Word doc, and then I'm just going to change it a little bit. You know, like, that's just not how it worked. So the fact that there are four Gospels like this that have so much
and other sources
in common,
as well outside,
and
of
other
Gospel.
Sources outside, just historical writings, Josephus, right? Exactly. So you've got Jesus, and the Romans didn't mess up crucifixion. It's not like, whoops, we got it wrong. He survived. Right. You know, like, that's one thing. Jesus is dead, and he died by Roman crucifixion. Two, the tomb is empty. Even Jesus's enemies admit that the tomb is empty. They come up with their own little crafty idea of the disciples robbing the tomb of the body. And that the reason why that pops up in one of the Gospels is because it's clear that's one of these things that's being said by the leaders of the time to sort of discredit the resurrection. Mm. And the apostles address it head on. And they address almost the ridiculous nature of such a claim. But so just for the sake of argument, let's not worry about how the tomb got empty for right now. Let's just say there was an empty tomb. So you got death, Jesus died, there is an empty tomb, there's no body that's ever been found. So the body of Jesus is gone, never been found. That's fact number three. Number four, all the apostles claimed that they saw him risen from the dead. That's not disputed. Everybody knows that that's what the apostles claimed. And by the way, they were willing to die rather than surrender such a belief. And then four, you've got St. Paul, who was the greatest persecutor of the church, who rounded up Christians to put them in jail and have them even killed for belief in Jesus as the Messiah, in almost like an instant converts and does a 180 and becomes one of the greatest, if not the greatest Christian preacher. Mm. And the whole Greek world is evangelized by him. So then the question now is, those are the facts.
And plus the hundreds of people that saw him, what was that?
Well, St. Paul says that. He says, not only did the apostles see him, not only did I see him, but there was hundreds. He appeared to 500 at once.
Right.
And so, like, you've got these sort of facts here. And now the question is, what is the explanation for these facts that nicely brings together all these various facts and gives an explanation that explains them all? And the only possible response is Jesus rose from the dead. Mm. Because all the other possible responses, for example, that the apostles stole the body, it's preposterous that they stole the body. What, they paid off the Roman guards who would have been killed by Pontius Pilate if they did such a thing, or if Jesus' body wasn't there and was stolen, they would have been killed. So why would the Roman guards do that? And then you've got the issue of the stone, the difficulty of rolling away the stone, and it was sealed on top of it. So how do they even manage to steal the body? And then, if you accept that they stole the body, you have to believe the apostles are not saints. They're like the greatest scoundrels that ever existed. They're liars. They're knaves. They made the whole thing up. And not only that, they're stupid because they got no fame, no fortune out of this, and just suffering and death. And with all due respect, they weren't all scholars. So then you've got them preaching and writing in such a way as if to have such command over the Old Testament when they did not have that kind of training. So they couldn't have made all of it up. They had to get it from somewhere. They had to receive it from somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. So So that is not plausible to my mind, that there's a fraud theory, because it you'd have to, anybody who says, oh, well, it was just a fraud, they stole the body, they have to say at the very next, in the very next breath, and the apostles were all knaves, liars, and terrible human beings who deceived the whole world. Certainly not saints. And then the next possibility is what? That they all had a corporate hallucination? Like everybody had the same hallucination. Not possible. People don't have a corporate hallucination. You don't have 500 people seeing the same hallucination, you know, and yet
right. That's
what you have. So like, and you, I could keep going in this but like, you know, the fact of the matter is no other potential way of answering how those five facts can
right. All
exist at the same time does an adequate job except that he rose from the dead. So I bring that up. Why? We're not going to believe that Jesus rose from the dead because reason tells us, right? But what is important to know is that there is evidence. There are reasons to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. And most people don't even know that.
Mm.
And then the question has to be a follow-up question. If, and of course we believe, yes, he did, if he rose from the dead, doesn't that fact change everything?
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. Am I living like Christ really rose from the dead?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really good point of reflection for all of us, maybe.
Yeah. Well, it also validates that he is the one true God. There's no other religious leader that rose from the dead and performed miracles. And
yeah.
So it's
and then you
got to
take what he said seriously because, he just proved who he said he was is true. So now I have to go. I can't look at what he says with the same view. I can't like take it or leave it.
Right.
These are words that come from the mouth of God.
So let's move along chronologically. What else happened? So then he's risen from the dead. He walks the earth for 40 days.
For 40 days to show that he was truly risen and to teach his apostles.
So the number 40 doesn't mean anything pertaining?
Well, I mean, I think it would mean anything that 40 typically refers to in the scriptures. So you've got, you know, obviously 40 days in the wilderness, 40 years in the wilderness. The Jews were after slavery from Egypt
into the promised land. He chose 40 days.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. And I would say if you were to relate it to anything, it would be to the Exodus experience. Because when Jesus dies on the cross and rises from the dead, that's the Passover lamb being slain.
That's
the new Exodus. It's not freedom from slavery in Egypt. It's freedom from sin and death, right? And from bondage to Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And then what? Then the 40 days is kind of like the 40 years in the wilderness before entering where? The promised land of heavens.
Right.
That Jesus ascends into heaven on the after 40 days.
And that's what happens. So what happens at the ascension then?
Okay. Yeah. So 40 days after his resurrection, he ascends into heaven, body and soul. He ascends. That's important. Mary is assumed into heaven, body and soul, we believe, that we call it the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary. That means that she was taken up by God. Jesus ascends. That means he is the efficient cause of his ascending. He goes
that's
up.
An interesting distinction.
Yeah.
I never heard it like that.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah, body and soul into heaven, right?
Yeah.
And why is it that he ascends from the Mount of Olives? When he's got his disciples there. He's got Mary there, probably some other people. And there's a series of reasons. So one, to take possession of the kingdom that he merited by his death. Two, to prepare a place of glory for all his disciples. To be our advocate and mediator with the Father in heaven, you know. And then to send the Holy Spirit upon the apostles. So that's why he ascended to heaven. Remember, he said, if I do not ascend, if I do not go, the Holy Spirit will not come to you. So he goes there in order to send the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
He sits at the right hand of the Father, which means that as God, Christ is equal to the Father, right? But as man, he holds the highest place in heaven. And the right hand is always the arm of honor and power. So being at the right hand means that he is sitting in honor and he is at the right hand of the power of God. And from there, he will come to judge the living and the dead, which we'll talk about that in our last episode when we talk about the last things.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, a lot of stuff we had to unpack in this episode.
Yeah.
So it was really great. Great stuff, Dave.
Awesome.
Until next time.
Excellent.
I am so glad that you joined us for this episode, truly informative and very enlightening. I want to remind you to please, please, please share this podcast with as many people as possible. The more people know about it, the more people we can affect and share the beautiful teachings of our Catholic Church. Also, stay connected with us by following us on your favorite social media platform at R4H Podcast. That is the letter R, the number 4, and the letter H Podcast. And also subscribe to our YouTube channel where you could see us on video. So thanks for joining us today. And there's always a reason for hope. This is Mario Costabile. Until next time, peace.